For some weeks, we have been studying the New Testament book called Hebrews, and we come this morning to the 7th of 13 chapters. Everything up to this point has been child's play. That is to say, the first 6 chapters have been relatively easy to understand, but today things change and become challenging. Starting here and continuing for the remainder, we must put on our thinking caps and carefully follow the writer's flow of thought as he goes from verse to verse. And the reason is because beginning this morning, you and I will be up here, up to our neck in deep theological truth and thought. And I want us to begin this morning not with verse 1 of chapter 7, but with verse 25. To help us do that now, please find this insert in your bulletin. This is the handout we'll be using this morning. If you don't have a handout, just raise your hand and one will be brought to you. Is anybody without this handout? If you don't have the handout now, you will be right here, folks. Howard, we need some handouts right over here. Oh, you got it? Well, we still need some handouts right over here. And we need a handout right up here. We've got some unfortunate souls in the congregation. If you don't have the handout now, take my word for it, you will be lost. So if you would, turn to verse 25. Here it is on the screen. It should be the very same that you've got in on the backside of your handout, verse 25. Now this verse says, for this reason. Now those first 3 words look back to the last part of verse 24, which says that Jesus holds his priesthood permanently. That is, he'll never die and have to be replaced by another priest. He'll never resign his position as a priest or retire and have to be replaced by somebody. He is a priest. That means to you and me a helper. He is a helper to us forever. For this reason, he, Jesus, is able to also keep on saving. Now, notice the word also. It's in italics. That is, it seems to be an unimportant word. It's very important. He is able to also keep on saving. The word also means in addition to Jesus reconciling you and me at conversion. In addition to Jesus bringing you and me when we were saved into a relationship with God and having our sins forgiven, post-conversion, he's able to also keep on saving. What I want to say is verse 25 has to do with Christ saving us, not at conversion, not when we were born again, not when we became Christians, but verse 25 has to do with Jesus saving us after conversion. For this reason, he is able. The Greek word translated able is dunamis. And from dunamis, we get the word, the English word dynamite. He has the power. He has the ability to do what? To keep on saving completely. Now, what is it that Christians need to be saved from after becoming Christians, after conversions? Folks, there is no end to the issues and difficulties in life that we need to be delivered from. From having no joy, we need to be delivered from anxiety and worry, from despair, from hopelessness, from the rule and dominion of sin in my life, from having no direction in future, from being discontent and dissatisfied, etc., etc. There is no limit to the ills that people, Christians, need to be rescued from after they become a Christian. Now let's go back to our verse. For this reason, Jesus is able to also keep on saving. Now notice this word, completely. Now that doesn't mean meagerly, partially, somewhat, but completely. Now this word completely is used only one other place in the New Testament. Here it is, Luke 13:11. There was a woman who for 18 years had a sickness and was bent double. She could not straighten up completely. Now, I take it that woman must have had a bent spine and she must have walked something like this. She could straighten up somewhat, but she could not straighten up completely, totally. So again, what this verse is affirming to you and me about Christ is he, after we become saved, can deliver you and me from whatever ills, difficulties, problems there are in life. And he doesn't rescue us partially, meagerly, in a half-baked manner. He totally, completely, thoroughly can deliver it. But notice the third line. He doesn't save just anybody and everybody. He saves those who come to God through him. And why is he able? Because he is always living. He is on the job 7/24. He doesn't take a day off. He doesn't sleep. He doesn't let you and me fall through the cracks. He doesn't forget about us from time to time. He is always living for the purpose of interceding on their behalf. What's interceding mean? He is talking to God about you, about your problems and your difficulties, and Christ is determined to get from God whatever you need to deliver you from the various ills of life. So this text says that Jesus completely saves us, but does he really do so? Let's step out of the classroom into the laboratory of life to find out. And now I want to mention this fellow right here. And would you notice his first two names, James Dean? He is my first cousin from Mississippi. He was given that name by his parents after the famous, or is it infamous, movie star in Hollywood, the original rebel, James Dean, back in the 50s. Remember how wild and rebellious James Dean, the movie star, was? And he was killed by driving his car too fast in an accident. And as that James Dean was wild and rebellious, so was this James Dean, my first cousin. James Dean may have believed in God, but he lived and acted as if there were no God. Years ago, I was down in Mississippi visiting my parents, and they said, "Your cousin James Dean is real eager to talk to you." Well, that was fine. I hadn't seen him in years. When I got with James Dean, I was shocked by what came out of his mouth. He was just on fire with a passion for Christ. I'd never heard him talk that way. What in the world happened to James Dean? He had been so sinful, so worldly, so evil, so deep in sin. And James Dean, I want you to know I was so impressed with him. I invited him to come up to Chicago to Moody Bible Institute two times. I took him into my classrooms, had him give his testimony to the students. I took him into a faculty meeting, had him give his testimony to the faculty. And one faculty member said later, it's rare to hear of such conviction in human soul wrought by the Spirit of God. And what happened to James Dean? Well, to use his favorite word, he was miserable. He didn't know that the deeper in sin he went, the farther away from God he drifted, and the deeper in misery and unhappiness he went. He didn't know that. And so he began to ask himself, "Why am I so miserable?" He wrongly concluded the reason for his unhappiness was his wife, Amanda. So he said, "You're the reason I'm so unhappy, and I am leaving you." He packed up and walked out, and she begged him, "Please don't leave me. I love you. I'm committed to our marriage. Don't leave me and my little boy. We'll go to a marriage counselor. I'll try and be a better wife, but don't leave me." He said, "No, you're the reason for unhappiness, and I'm leaving." He did. His misery continued for some months. And so he asked himself, "I've left the cause of my misery, my wife, but I'm still miserable. Why?" Then he reached a second erroneous conclusion. "Maybe I haven't gone far enough in leaving her. It's not sufficient to walk out on her. I need to divorce her." So on a Sunday night, he told his wife, "This week, go to the lawyer and file for divorce." And she said, "Oh no, I beg of you, don't divorce me. Come back to me. Let's make a go of our marriage." "No, you're the reason I'm unhappy. It's not enough for me to leave you. I need to divorce you and get you out of my life." And he said, "If you don't go to the lawyer and file, I'll have to go to the lawyer, and I can't afford to take time off work." And when he went to sleep that night, just before going to bed, Sunday night, he said, for the first time in his life, he prayed. And what did James Dean say to God in his first prayer? "God, I am so miserable. Please don't let me wake up in the morning." And he said, "The very thought that came to me after I uttered those words were, if you don't wake up on earth, where will you wake up? Hell." And he said, "Now, I was too unhappy to live, but too scared to die." That Wednesday, Amanda went to the lawyer and filed for divorce at her husband's urging. That Friday, James Dean is up early. He drives a truck. He's on the highway by 6 a.m. And he doesn't know that he is about to have the biggest encounter of his life. He tells me soon after he got on the highway and was going down the road, he passed a billboard with the words on it, God, Christ can put right whatever's wrong in your life. And he said, when I read those words, they were so foolish, I laughed and said outside out loud to myself, Christ could not possibly clean up the mess that my life is in. And he said, 10 miles further down the road, the Son of God proved me dead wrong. It was as though heaven opened and the Spirit of God fell upon me, bringing the deepest conviction of sins. And now before my eyes, I could see sins that years ago I'd committed and long since forgotten. And I felt like I was standing as a sinful man before a holy God condemned for my sins. And I began to weep uncontrollably. And I almost overturned that 18-wheel diesel that I was driving 60 miles an hour down the road. And I wept so profusely that for the remainder of that day, I could not stop weeping. And I took my truck from business to business and unloaded the cargo I had. And people would notice me weeping. And they would come up and say, ask, why are you crying? Can we help you? And he said, I couldn't talk to anybody. After unloading all of my freight at the last business, I started back home. I passed a Baptist church on the road, on the side of the road, and I went in not knowing the pastor, and I asked him, I don't know if anything can be done about my sin. Do I have any hope? And the pastor led me to Christ. Now James Dean goes back to his wife and says, the problem never has been you, it's been me. Let's forget the divorce. And what does Amanda say? No, indeed. I want the divorce and I am going to get it. I think she suffered from wounded pride. And it took about a year for that divorce to come through. And I can remember a number of times James Dean and I would pray earnestly that God would change his wife's heart and be open to reconciliation, but she never was. She got a divorce and married a cowboy from Texas, and James Dean puts it this way. That experience that I went through of losing my wife was the worst thing that ever happened to me. It is my fault, he said. I caused that divorce. But yet, meeting Christ has been the best thing that has ever happened to me. My misery is gone, and now I enjoy life. And I want you to know that James Dean has gone on with God. He is serving today as a deacon in his church. He has a wonderful ministry with teenagers in the community. He did everything he could to get his wife back. He failed, and God has now recently given him a wonderful wife, and he's happily married. Did Christ save James Dean from his misery? He did. Well, he didn't give him his wife back, but my interpretation of losing Amanda is this. He caused it. And I asked Amanda one time, do you see any difference in your husband now that he's become a Christian? She said, I see a huge change in James Dean, and I cannot explain the change. He's so different than what he was. But she never became a Christian. And I just wonder if God didn't remove her from his life so he could give him a woman who knows Christ and loves him. Now let me tell you about Mickey and Cheryl. I had Mickey as a student at Moody Bible Institute. His wife Cheryl wasn't a student there, but she worked on campus. And they had a really bad marriage. And Mickey tells me one night he had a meeting at church. And his wife Cheryl was so unhappy in marriage. She was in the floor rolling over and over, moaning and crying out how unhappy she was and what a bad husband she had. And James Dean said, I knew if I went to that meeting at church, I would come home to a dead wife. Because as she was rolling in the floor, moaning over her unhappy marriage, she was talking about ending her life. I didn't dare go to that church meeting. I stayed up and watched her all night. In fact, I didn't even go to sleep. I watched her to make sure she didn't hurt herself. And then one morning, he and I had breakfast together at the Institute. And here's what Mickey said. I am willing to obey any command God points out. I am willing to forsake any sin in my life that he brings to my attention. I'm willing to make any sacrifice if God will just reach down and heal my marriage. Now, I've heard of this happening before. This is the only marriage I've ever been involved in where I saw it happen. And what did I see? Miraculously, overnight, God did it. He reached down and healed that terrible marriage. And today, Mickey and Cheryl have a wonderful marriage. He is a pastor of a church in Maryland, fruitful pastor, and she is a skilled pastor's wife who loves her husband and a good mother. Now, what is our verse saying? Jesus is able to completely save you and me from whatever difficulty, ill problem we have in life. Now, I want you to take your hand out, look on the front side, and have summed up the main point of our chapter in this one statement. Through our eternal priest, Jesus, we are brought into an ideal relationship with God. Now, that's a loaded statement. We may not see that it bristles with implication. An ideal relationship with God comes through Christ. And also accompanying an ideal relationship with God is what we saw this morning in our Sunday school class in Psalm 119, where the writer says, because of his relationship with God, while he has enemies and lots of problems in life, he has joy and he has great transcendent peace. So it's through Christ that we are brought into a relationship with God, and accompanying as a part of that relationship is joy, peace, satisfaction, contentment in life. Now, once you take your hand out, and let's look at the first three verses, Hebrews 7, 1 through 3. Now, keep in mind, folks, we are about to step into the Pacific Ocean of theological thought. And now as we walk out deeper and deeper, here's what's going to happen. The water is going to become up higher and higher to our necks. So this morning, again, to repeat myself, here is where we're going to find ourselves this morning, in deep theological thought. So we must put on our thinking caps. And again, you're going to sense the challenge this morning as we go through this difficult path. I'm going to do my very best to make it as clear as possible. And even so, it will be a challenge for us to get our mind around this. Now, I want you to know that the first three verses in the Greek text compose but one lengthy sentence. And here's what I suggest. That you go to line 1 of verse 1 and with your pen underline the third word, Melchizedek. There is our grammatical subject. Then I suggest you go down to verse 3, the last line, and underline remains a priest forever. So there is the chief thought in this lengthy sentence that spans three verses. Now, what's he saying? Melchizedek remains a priest forever. That's what the writer says. That's not really what he means. What he means is this right here. Jesus Christ remains a priest forever. Why is he talking about Melchizedek? Melchizedek only illustrates what Jesus actually is, namely a priest forever. And what does that mean to be a priest forever? Priest, he is the one who helps you and me into a relationship with God. He is one who helps you and me after we enter a relationship with God. He helps us with our problems, tragedies, trials, needs, difficulties in life. And how long is he going to be on the job? For a while. Most of the time, look at that last word, forever. In fact, as we go through our passage, I want to point out some of the expressions in chapter 7 that refer to eternity. We're going to come across in verse 3 this statement, He, Jesus, remains a priest forever. Verse 16, He has the power of an indestructible life. Now, if He has an indestructible life, what does that mean? He lives forever. Verse 17 and 21, God is going to say to Jesus, You are a priest for how long? Forever. Verse 24, Jesus holds His priesthood without succession. He'll never stop being a priest so that somebody has to replace Him. Verse 25, He is always living. Verse 28, He is forever perfect. Now, all of that is going to imply this. Our salvation is just as safe and secure as Jesus is an eternal priest. Now, let's go back to chapter 7 and verse 1. For this Melchizedek, now I want you to know, there are only two references in the entire Old Testament to this mysterious man called Melchizedek. One is a historical reference in Genesis 14. The other is a prophetical reference to him in Psalm 110. Now, here is what the writer is going to do. And we need to understand this so we can follow his thinking in the first three verses. He is going to Genesis 14. And from that chapter, the writer is going to select five historical facts about Melchizedek. And I've laid this out before you. Look at verse 1, the second line, 1 in parentheses. There's the first historical fact. The third line in verse 1, 2 in parentheses. 3, 4 in parentheses. Verse 2, the initial line, 5 in parentheses. So the writer is going to mention 5 facts about Melchizedek that he gleans from Genesis 14. Then beginning with the second line in verse 2, he is going to interpret for you and me these 5 historical remarks. All right, so let's go to verse 1. For this Melchizedek, now the first historical fact about Melchizedek is he says he was a king over Salem. Salem was the ancient name of Jerusalem. So he's telling us that Melchizedek was the king of Jerusalem. 2 in parentheses. He was also a priest of the Most High God. All right, Melchizedek wore 2 hats. He was a king and he was a priest. 3 in parentheses. He met Abraham as Abraham was returning from the defeating the kings. Abraham took his servants and went and attacked 4 kings from Mesopotamia, and God enabled him to defeat those 4 kings. And after the battle, Melchizedek met Abraham as he was returning from the battle. Last line of verse 1, and who, the word who refers to Melchizedek, and Melchizedek blessed Abraham. And then in the initial line of verse 2, the 5th fact about Melchizedek is mentioned. So that even Abraham apportioned a tenth of all to him. A tenth of what? We just defeated 4 Mesopotamian kings. And then Abraham acquired all of their possessions, their loot, their booty. He required great treasure from those Mesopotamian kings that he defeated in battle. And after he was coming back home, he had all this treasure, wealth, possessions taken from the defeated kings. And he cut into it and gave Melchizedek 1/10, 10% of all that booty. Now, beginning with the second line in verse 2, the writer is going to interpret for us these 5 facts. First, when translated, his name, Melchizedek's name, means king of righteousness. And it certainly does. Here's his name, Melchizedek. Now, the first 5 letters, Melchi, in Hebrew, means king. And the last half of the name, Zedek, means righteousness. He was the king of righteousness. I'm in the last line of verse 2. And next, also, king of Salem, which means king of peace. Now, what does it mean, he was king of righteousness? It means that he was righteous. He was a righteous person. It means, secondly, as a king, he was righteous and just and fair in his treatment of all his subjects. Saddam Hussein was the bloody dictator of Iran. Was he just and fair in the way he treated people? No. But Melchizedek, he was a ruler. He was righteous, just, fair, kind, equitable in his treatment of all his subjects. And thirdly, it means as a king of right, he required his citizens to themselves live righteously. Now, verse 3 continues interpreting the historical facts about Melchizedek. Melchizedek was, verse 3 tells us, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God. How can the writer of Hebrews say about this man, this human being, Melchizedek, that he didn't have a dad? He didn't have a mom. He didn't have a birthday. There never was a day that he died. In fact, he lives forever. He was made like the Son of God. Now, you're probably, here's the comparison that he's making. That Melchizedek was a king and a priest. Now, what he's going to say is, so was Jesus a king and a priest. He was a king of righteousness and king of peace. So was Jesus, king of righteousness and king of peace. Melchizedek didn't have any parents. He didn't have a family tree that he came from. He never was born. He never died. In fact, he's a priest forever. How can the writer of Hebrews make such astounding remarks about Jesus? Well, you're probably aware that the Bible uses types. And what is a type? A type is a divinely intended historical illustration of something already past, Melchizedek, that symbolizes something future called the antitype, Jesus. Melchizedek is an illustration of Jesus. Now let's go back just for a moment to this. What is said about Melchizedek being a king and priest is to be literally understood. He actually was a king of Jerusalem. He was a real priest. And that is certainly true of Jesus. He is a king and he is a priest. Melchizedek was a king of righteousness and peace, literally to be understood, as is Jesus. But now when it says that Melchizedek had no parents, no family tree, he was never born, never died, he remains a priest forever, he is only speaking figuratively, non-literally. And why? Melchizedek, the writer of Hebrews, sees as much significance in what the book of Genesis does not say about Melchizedek as it sees what he does say about him. What is the book of Genesis from which he gets these five historical facts? It is a book of genealogy. All the major figures in the book of Genesis were told three things about those major figures: who their father was, when they were born, and when they died. The book of Genesis says nothing about Melchizedek's father. Doesn't tell us when he was born. Doesn't tell you when he was died. So the writer's thinking this way. Since Genesis doesn't mention his father, his birthday, his death day, figuratively speaking, typically speaking, Melchizedek didn't have any parents. He never was born. He never did die. So here's what he's saying. As Melchizedek figuratively, that is, not speaking literally, had no parents, had no genealogy, had no day of birth, day of death, and as he figuratively is a priest forever, what is true of Melchizedek in figure is true of Christ in reality. What is true of Melchizedek in type is true of Jesus in fact. But we still have a bit of a problem, don't we? And the problem is this. Didn't Jesus have a mother? Yes, he came out of Mary's womb. Didn't Jesus have a family tree? He came from the line of David, the Jews. Wasn't there a day when Jesus was born? We celebrated every Christmas. Wasn't there a day when he died? Yes. So how can the writer even make these statements about Jesus? I want you to go to verse 3. Look at the third line. Melchizedek is made like, not the Son of Man. That title emphasizes Jesus' humanity. He was made like the Son of God. That stresses Jesus' deity. Now, remember, Jesus is unique. He is one person with two natures, human and divine. As a man, Jesus certainly had a mother. He came out of a family. He was born, he died. But as God, he doesn't have any parents. He doesn't have any family tree. There was never a day when, as God, Jesus was born and came into being. And as God, he's never died. So the writer is making Melchizedek into a type. So he ends verse 3 by saying, Melchizedek, and really what he means here is Jesus remains a priest forever. Now that's the main thought of the first three verses. What's the main thought? Christ is your priest forever. Meaning what? Your helper. The one who brings you into a relationship with God and maintains that relationship for you with God. And how long will he maintain your relationship with God? Forever. Now verse 4 turns to a new point, and that is that Melchizedek is greater than all the Levitical priests. And why is he going to make this point? Because the readers of Hebrews are so discouraged as Christians, they're thinking about getting up, walking out of the Christian church, and returning to the Jewish synagogue and returning to Judaism. They're thinking about tossing Christianity overboard. And the writer's going to say Jesus is a greater priest than a Levitical priest. And why is he going to make that point? Since he's a greater priest than all the Jewish priests, Christ can do more for you, better help you than the Jewish priest can help and minister to you. Verse 4. Now, consider how great this man Melchizedek must have been, so that even Abraham, the great patriarch, gave him a tenth of the choicest spoils of war. All that loot and booty that Abraham obtained from defeating those Mesopotamian kings, he gave 10% of it to Melchizedek. Now, it was recognized in antiquity that a person was required to tithe, give 10% of all that he had to religious and political authorities. And that's what Abraham did. However, Melchizedek was not Jewish. Look at verse 5. But this man, again talking about Melchizedek, although he does not trace his genealogy from the Jews, collected a tithe from Abraham. So the first point that he's going to make here is, in showing Melchizedek's superiority over the Levitical priest, Abraham, from whom all Jewish priests came, paid a tithe to Melchizedek. The point is this. Let me repeat myself. Way back in antiquity, you were required to give 10% of your income and possessions to political authorities and to religious authorities. And to pay a tithe to somebody indicated his authority over you. Well, if Abraham gave a tithe to Melchizedek, that's showing that Melchizedek was greater in authority than Abraham. Notice the last part of verse 5. And he, Melchizedek, blessed him who had the promises. So the second way that the writer sees Melchizedek's superiority over Abraham, the Levitical priest, is Melchizedek blessed Abraham. Now, what does it mean to bless somebody? Listen carefully. That means that you have such a tight, healthy relationship with God, you can pray to God and bring down God's blessing on somebody that you are concerned about. You have such a healthy, strong relationship with God, you can pray to God and ask God to bless this person over here that's struggling, or this person over here that you're concerned about. To bless somebody is to bring heaven's blessings down on that person's head. I used to be in a church in Dallas, Texas. There was a real fine Christian woman in there. She was concerned about her husband and his smoking. She called him a smokestack. She was concerned that smoking was going to give him cancer. So she began to earnestly pray. Her husband had tried to stop. She had begged him to quit. He tried to quit. He just couldn't quit smoking. Tobacco had that strong a grip on him. So she rolled up her sleeves and she went to praying for him. He fell very ill. The physicians could not figure out what made this man sick. And he was in bed for about a month. He was so sick. And when he thought about cigarettes, it made him sicker. When he remembered how cigarettes smelled, it made him even more sick. And then after a month, his strength came back. And from that point on, he didn't want anything to do with cigarettes. Now, I think what that woman did is she blessed her husband. She beseeched God and asked God to deliver her smokestack from smoking cigarettes to preserve his life. She called down God's blessing on her husband's head. Melchizedek called for a great blessing upon Abraham. And what blessing did Melchizedek ask God to bestow upon Abraham? When this man goes to war against those four Mesopotamian kings, make him victorious over those kings, and God did it. Now, verse 6 states the significance of this blessing. Beyond any dispute, the inferior is blessed by the superior. Now, Abraham was a great man. We all know that. Melchizedek was the only man Abraham ever recognized to be his spiritual superior. Now, verse 7 shows another indication of Melchizedek's superiority over Levi. And in one case, dying men collect tithes. Jewish priests live so long and they die. But in the other case, one, Melchizedek, collected a tithe of whom witness is born, he continues living. What's he saying here? Showing Melchizedek's superiority over the Jewish priest, it's not only that Abraham tithed to him, not only that Melchizedek blessed him, but Melchizedek is alive today. Not literally, but typically, figuratively, he still is alive. Why? How does the writer say that? Because Genesis never mentions his death, so figuratively speaking, he remains alive. Now, let's sum up that paragraph. What's he saying? Melchizedek, and really what he's getting at is not Melchizedek, but Jesus. Since Melchizedek illustrates Jesus, Jesus is greater than Abraham and all the Levitical priests that descend from him. Now, again, why is he making that statement? I know that you guys are thinking about leaving Christianity and going back to Judaism. Don't do so. Christ is able to do far more for you, help you, minister to you, deliver you from problems and difficulties, maintain your relationship with God. He can do far more for you than the Levitical priest can do for you if you return to Judaism. Now, verse 11 shows the need to have a priest like Melchizedek. Now, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood. Now, what does he mean by perfection? Perfection is bringing a sinner that you and me into an ideal relationship with God. And would you notice the second word in verse 11? If perfection were through the Levitical priesthood. I want you to know that in Greek, that word if means if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, but it wasn't. The old Jewish covenant and all Jewish priests could never bring a human being, a sinner, into a proper, ideal relationship with God. That's what he's saying. Now let's look at verse 11 in that light. If perfection were through Levitical priesthood, and it wasn't, there would be no further need for a different kind of priest to arise, that is, one to be designated according to the order of Melchizedek, and not according to the order of Aaron. And what does it mean? What the writer's saying is, since the Jewish priests could not bring you and me into a proper relationship with God, there needs to be the appearance of a new priest, not like Aaron, but like Melchizedek. And what is a priest according to the order of Melchizedek like? He has the same position, king and priest. He has the same function to reconcile sinners with God and rule over them. And he's going to be a priest for the same duration forever. Now, verse 12 confirms the new priest is not like Aaron. For when the priesthood is changed, there necessarily must occur an abrogation of the law. Now, we're all familiar with the President of the United States. That position, that office, rests upon the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution authorizes the existence and establishes for the position of the President of the United States. Now, the writer's thinking this way. If we're going to change the stipulations about our president, we're going to change something else, the U.S. Constitution, because the Constitution authorizes the president. Did you know that in order for a person to be the president of the United States, He must be born geographically within the boundaries of the United States. You cannot have a person in the Oval Office as president who, even if he's an American citizen, was born outside the United States in another country, even if he was born to American parents. Now, let's suppose in the next election, the people of America demand that my older son, Joseph, be the new president. Well, the U.S. Constitution won't allow him to be because he was born in England. Even though Joseph was born in England to an American dad and an American mother, and I made a trip to London to get American citizenship for him, the U.S. Constitution will not permit Joseph to be your next president. But let's suppose the American people demand that he become the president. All we got to do is change the Constitution. We can have a new amendment to it. Then, since the law has been changed, Joseph can become the next president. Now, what the writer's really getting at is this. The Mosaic Law authorizes Jewish priests. And the writer has just said, the Levitical priesthood is inadequate. We need to get rid of it and bring a new priest in. Well, if we're going to get rid of the Levitical priesthood and bring a new priest in that's not Levitical, we've got to change the authority which provides for the new priest. Verse 16 specifies what the Mosaic Law required. Who, talking about priest, Jesus has become a priest not by virtue of legal requirement concerning physical descent. Now what that's saying, folks, is this. Here's what the Mosaic Law required of Levitical priest. The Old Testament said that the Levitical priest had to be from the tribe of Levi. Couldn't come from any other tribe. And the Levitical priest's mother had to be an Israelite. It was not good enough that the priest's father was a Jew if the priest's mother was a Gentile. No, both parents had to be Jewish. And the priest's father had himself to be a priest. And the priest could have no bodily defect. He couldn't be missing a finger from his hand. He could not walk with a limp. What do those requirements have to do with spirituality and moral fitness? Nothing. Now, we're looking for a new pastor. Suppose the search committee decided that our new pastor had to be from the state of Illinois. We cannot hire a new pastor from any other state except this one. And our new pastor's mother must be an American. It's not enough that our pastor's father is an American. No, his mother cannot be born in another country. She must be an American. And our new pastor, his father, had to be a pastor before him. And our new pastor can have no bodily defect. He cannot have bad eyesight. He cannot walk with a limp. He cannot be hard of hearing. If we had those requirements, they would have little, if anything, to do with spiritual fitness and morals. Now, let's go back to look at verse 16. Jesus has become a priest not by all of this concerning the body. In verse 17, the last part of verse 16, but he has become a priest by virtue of the power of an indestructible life. So what the writer is going to say is Jesus is superior over the Levitical priest, and here's one reason why. His priesthood is based on greater authority, not bodily requirements, but his priesthood rests on something firmer. Verse 17 substantiates this claim. For he, Jesus, has testimony borne about him. He's going to quote Psalm 110, verse 4. You are a priest forever, just like Melchizedek. So what is the greater authority? His eternal life, not his physical body. A better priest means a more effective priesthood. Verse 19, there has occurred the introduction of a better hope. Now, with Jesus being our priest, we have a better hope. And that better hope is this right here. Permanent forgiveness of sins, faithful divine help in this life, and a home in heaven. There has occurred the introduction of a better hope, because through it we draw near to God. And what does it mean to draw near to God? It means to enjoy an ideal, proper relationship with the Lord. So Jesus' priesthood is more effective than the Jewish priesthood. Christ can do more for us than the Jewish priest did for the Israelites. Now, verse 20 mentions a third token showing that Jesus has a better priesthood. His is guaranteed by divine oath, and the Levitical priesthood is not guaranteed by hope. Look at verse 20. Jesus has not become a priest without an oath, and the oath is given in verse 21. By the one God who said to him, the Lord has actually sworn and will not change his mind, you, Jesus, are a priest forever. Now, folks, what that means is this. When God appointed Jesus to the priesthood, he took an oath and swore, you're going to be a priest, not for a long time, but forever. God rarely ever swears. I'm not talking about using profanity. He rarely ever swears and takes an oath. When God takes an oath, he puts something in cement and he never changes his mind. He never goes back on it. When he made Jesus a priest, God swore that he'd be a priest forever. In contrast with an eternal priest, verse 23, and they, on the one hand, who have become priests are many because they are prevented by death from remaining in office. There are many Levitical priests. Why? Because they died and have to be replaced by others. Verse 24, but he, on the other hand, because he lives forever, holds his priesthood without succession. He'll never die and have to be replaced. Verse 25, for this reason, he is able to also keep on saving completely those who come to God through him. Why? Because he's always living for the purpose of interceding on their behalf. Now, verse 26 concludes and presents Jesus as the ideal priest. Thus, such an ideal high priest was precisely suitable for us. Some of you have seen the movie, read the book, Stand By Me. You remember what that was about? In the 70s, a black man retired as a sergeant from the army. Went to college, majored in education, and began teaching in public schools. He was quite an effective school teacher. So good, they took him out of elementary school and made him the principal of an inner city high school in New Jersey. And that high school in New Jersey was out of control. There was a lot of truancy, low faculty morale. The students attacked, beat up the teachers. And they put this former Army sergeant as a principal in control of that high school. Hollywood made a movie about him. And he would walk the hallways with a baseball bat in this hand and a bullhorn in this hand, shouting out orders, get to class. He drove all the drug addicts out of the school. He got rid of the problem students. He instilled discipline. He turned that high school around and made it a successful high school. And the teacher morale rose and rose. And they interviewed students and faculty member. And one faculty member says, this principal stands by us and supports us. And one student said, he is just what this school needed. Now the writer is saying, Jesus is just the priest you and I as sinful people need. And notice how he's described in verse 26. Holy, that concerns his relationship with God. Harmless, that concerns his relationship with people. He never injured anybody. He was never a bad influence on anybody. Unstained, that concerns his relationship with himself. He never tainted himself. Different from sinners, removed from sin in heart and life. Exalted above the heavens. This refers to his relationship with God. There's nothing between him and God. Verse 27 further describes this ideal priest who does not need daily, as those Jewish priests, to offer sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for those of the sins of the people. For this he did once and for all when he offered up himself. He has no sin of his own that he has to deal with. By the way, when you bring a new pastor in here, you are surely aware he struggles every day with sin, just like you do. And your new pastor will have to deal firstly with his own sin every day so he can help you and me with our sins. This is saying Jesus doesn't have any sin that he's got to take care of first. Then he can help you and me. He doesn't have any sin. Verse 28 justifies Jesus having no sin of his own. For the law appoints as high priest mere human beings who have moral weakness. But the word of the oath, which came at later than the law, appoints one who is nothing less than a divine son, forever morally perfect and perfectly qualified. So, what is this passage saying to you and me? Well, I think several things. Firstly, it's only through Jesus Christ that a human being can enter into a proper, ideal relationship with God. What did Jesus himself say? I am the way, the truth, the life. Nobody comes to God except through me. Secondly, Christ is our priestly helper. He is eternally on the job, 7/24. He doesn't fall asleep. He doesn't lose sight of you. You don't fall through the cracks. His eyes are wide open. He knows all our struggles and problems. He is there, 7/24, on the job to help you and me. He can completely save us in whatever areas with whatever problems and difficulties we need help. He saves us completely, not half-heartedly, not meagerly, not partially. And lastly, he is harmless. He will do you and me no harm. In fact, nothing but good. So, Father, we thank you for your grace and provision. You have given us just what we need. An ideal priest. That is to say, an ideal helper who is compassionate and sympathetic. And when we hurt, he hurts. But he's also faithful. He is absolutely reliable. Whenever we need him, he will be there. Now, may we never think about abandoning him for somebody or something inferior. He is just what we need. And I pray that this week we will experience, we will be on the receiving end of his faithful, gracious help. In Jesus' name, amen.